Hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and on iTunes at College Radio. Today is Wednesday, March 5th, 2014. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today is Daniel Jones. Every year I feature the ASJA Annual Writers Conference keynote speaker, and this year our keynote is Daniel. He has edited the Modern Love column in the Sunday Style section of the New York Times since its inception in October of 2004. His books include two essay anthologies, Modern Love, 50 True and Extraordinary Tales of Desire, Deceit, and Devotion, and The Bastard on the Couch, 27 Men Try Really Hard to Explain Their Feelings About Love, Loss, Fatherhood, and Freedom, and a novel, After Lucy, a finalist for the Barnes & Noble Discover Award. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Elle, Parade, Real Simple, and Harper's Bazaar. Originally from Pittsburgh, he attended the University of Virginia and the University of Arizona. He currently lives with his wife, writer Kathy Hanauer, and their two children in Northampton, Mass. And he's here today to talk about his new book, Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers, published by William Morrow. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Good to have you. Let's begin by hearing you talk a bit about the book and how it came about.
Well, I had been editing the Modern Love column for about 7 or 8 years. And when you have this kind of deadline-driven job where submissions are pouring in over the transom and you're trying to meet your weekly deadline and do all of that kind of work, it's hard sometimes to pull back with a sense of perspective and actually find out what you're learning and what all these stories are teaching you. And this book was my attempt to get some perspective on all this material that has been filtering through me over the years, with more coming in every day. And what were the trends, and what were people struggling with, and what was technology doing, and how is it affecting relationships, and how were people viewing family and marriage maybe differently than they had in the past? I had just, my head was filled with questions, and all of the people who write into me are filled with questions, often that don't have answers, and I wanted to wrestle with those, and a book was really the only way to do that.
I found the tone and the style and the humor of the book so funny, actually, and light. And I was curious if this is your writing style or your voice or the voice for this particular book.
I guess I have to say it is. Yeah, I it's hard. You know, a lot of these stories are very poignant, and they're often the most important story in the person's life, and they're often very sad. But when you look at the way people behave in relationships in groups, or even as herds, as I sometimes feel like I see people behaving, it can be funny. And the way that we try, you know, love really stymies our attempts to understand it and make sense of it. And yet we keep trying new ways of trying to make relationships easier and smoother and less prone to conflict, and we rationalize in similar ways, and those patterns were just inevitably funny to me. And I felt like, you know, most love books are serious, and sometimes scientific analysis or sociological analysis, and I really wanted to have fun with this book.
Well, I also found it funny that you said that you're not romantic, that both you and your wife are not exactly romantic types, that you forget your anniversary, and I found it a little ironic, you know, seeing how you're editor of Modern Love.
It's true, although I can't say that I think of the column as being all that romantic. You know, it's about romantic love more than it's about, you know, familial love or other kinds of love, but I feel like what's interesting about the column is how often realistic and gritty it is, and I think it does not romanticize love. And in that sense, I feel like our relationship, which is really always has been about being able to talk about honestly about anything having to do with relationships, is probably a good model for what the what the column's really about. It's about getting beyond the fantasy and actually grappling with what relationships really are.
Talk about how the Modern Love column came about, which I find really interesting as well.
Yeah, me too. We, my wife and I had edited companion essay anthologies about relationships that were really about people who were struggling with this, particularly women in my wife's book, which was called The Bitch in the House and was a bestseller. And it was about women in this post-feminist promise of being able to have it all and have marriage and career and motherhood and have it all work harmoniously. And it wasn't working harmoniously, and the relationships were suffering and marriage was suffering as a result. So she had a book, edited a book, The Bitch in the House, that examined that with 26 women. And then, as you mentioned in the intro, I then had my male rebuttal, which was called The Bastard on the Couch, and was the befuddled male response to these shifting power dynamics, really, in contemporary relationships, and how that's affecting people's everyday lives. And those books together, especially because they were edited by husband and wife, just really made a big splash and got a lot of attention. And one of the people who sat up and took notice was the style editor at the New York Times, a guy named Trip Gabriel. And he liked the material in the books. He wanted to have a column that ran weekly in Sunday Styles that would have that similar kind of material. And because we had this track record of two books and having produced that kind of material, he contacted us about editing it as a couple. And we weren't all that sure it was a good idea at the beginning. We didn't really understand. We didn't see that kind of material in Styles or in the newspaper already, and weren't quite sure who would read it and who, why that was, you know, something they would want. But we couldn't say no, and we started the column together. But it was really a one-person job. It would have been too distracting as a half-time job for a couple. And she was working on a novel at the time. So I very quickly, within a few months, took it over. And, yeah, that was coming up on 10 years ago this summer.
That's amazing. That's amazing. You are listening to Writers on Writing. My guest is Daniel Jones. His new book is Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers, published by William Morrow. How did you choose which stories to include in the book, or which trends or themes to touch on?
Well, I struggled with what I was going... In the early stages of this book, I knew I wanted to write it, but what was I going to say? And what could I bring to this subject that, you know, it's a subject that's been written about exhaustively from all angles. And, well, what can I bring to it? And what I really could bring to it were anecdotes, and not just, you know, people dismiss anecdotes as being not substantive. But when you have 50,000 of them, it starts to add up to a lot of behaviors that you can write about and learn from. And so in this case, the book started to come to life to me when I wrote the first words of what then became the introduction, which were, let's start with a quiz. And I'd seen all of these books that were about love and relationships that had quizzes, and you would answer and you would get a score, and then that score would mean something, although I was never sure what. And it occurred to me that what I was hearing from people weren't questions that had answers like that. They were questions that didn't have answers, and sometimes you didn't really know the answers your whole life in terms of what is the best way to approach a certain situation in a relationship. So very quickly, 10 questions came to me, and then I wrestled in each chapter with each of those 10 questions, and whatever anecdotes and stories contributed and illuminated those questions and indicated trends, you know, more than just the one person who had experienced it, but that story represented many others. Those were the stories that I included. And in most cases, they were stories I published. In some cases, they were stories that I just heard or someone had told me somewhere along the way. I've become this filter for everyone's love stories, improbably enough.
Were you surprised with how popular the column became?
Yeah, I continue to be surprised by it. I like this material a lot, and my wife likes this kind of material a lot, and people really talking honestly about relationships, but you never know if, you know, how that's going to go over. And to be honest, when it first began appearing in Sunday Styles, a lot of times readers were shocked by it, and we would get emails and letters in response where people were really taken aback by the bluntness with which people were describing their sex lives and their private lives. And that has changed over the years. It's really become an accepted part of the newspaper, and has become, it seems to me, from what I hear in feedback, more appreciated year after year after year, more read in greater volume year after year, and it's really created its own audience.
Well, you know, a minute ago you talked about, you know, people talking honestly about their love lives and sex lives, and I was curious what sort of fact-checking you could possibly do with a personal essay, with personal essays that come in. I mean, you know, do you ever suspect that what you're reading is fictional because it's too outrageous, or do you just have to kind of believe that what you're getting is true?
Well, from where I sit, I always have to be suspicious. So I have to begin with that stance with almost any story I get. And some things in a personal essay you can check, and it really depends on the story, what's available to you as an editor or a fact checker to reassure yourself that what you're reading is true and actually happened. And, you know, some stories will make me more suspicious than others, and I'll ask, you know, at times I'll ask for supporting documentation or, but a lot can be discovered just through a long conversation with someone. And what's important, though, is unlike a news article in the newspaper, it's not and doesn't promise to be a balanced account of a relationship. It's one, a personal essay is one person's perspective, and they're entitled to that perspective. And as long as I'm reassured that it happened and that it is true to their memory, that's what's most important. I have sometimes sought out other people in the essays to make sure that it's not, the basic facts are not contested. But we're only interested in the one person's version of the story. You know, my wife and I don't even agree on the circumstances of how we became engaged, and she remembers it one way, and I remember it another way, and she says that I did something that I don't remember doing at all. You know, if I tell that story in a personal essay, we don't have to include her account. Mm-hmm. It's important that it's my account and my memory, and that's true in the column as well.
That's interesting. I'd love to hear you read from your book.
Well, let me pick out, I have a passage just very early on to give you a flavor of it.
Okay.
This just appears near the beginning of the introduction. Here we go. At the New York Times, I edit a personal essay column called Modern Love, in which strangers spill their guts about their relationship woes. It's a job I have worked at more or less full-time for the past 9 years, a period during which some 50,000 laments about love have filtered through my brain and, often, my heart. The stories arrive by email around the clock, pouring into my laptop, dribbling out of my printer, and spilling across the tables of my office and home. They follow me into bed at night, tag along on family vacations, and ping into my iPhone when I'm walking my dogs or standing on the sidelines of my son's soccer games. They also frequently are told to me in person, at cocktail parties and public events, and in planes, trains, and automobiles. When people find out what I do, they invariably say, "You must know a lot about love." Or they might invoke the name of the newspaper sex columnist played by Sarah Jessica Parker on Sex and the City and remark, "You're like a male Carrie Bradshaw." The first person to make that observation was a journalist who interviewed me early on in my job when I was so out of the loop love-wise that I didn't even know who Carrie Bradshaw was. I thought the journalist had said Carrie Bradshaw, the famous Steelers quarterback, now Fox Sports analyst, I'd grown up idolizing during my suburban Pittsburgh childhood. It didn't occur to me to ask what Terry Bradshaw had to do with editing confessional essays about relationships. All I could think was, I'm like a male Terry Bradshaw? But he is male. Shows how little I knew about love back then. Now, 9 years later, I apparently know enough about love to fill a book.
That was hilarious. I laughed when I read it, and I'm laughing now.
It's true.
That's great.
Totally true. I was on the phone with her, and I thought, Terry Bradshaw? Make any sense on any level?
Oh, that's funny. I love that about this book. There's so many funny parts like that. So I totally forgot about what I was going to ask you next. But one of the things I wanted to ask you was, what kind of writer are you in terms of, do you barrel through the first draft? Did you barrel through the draft of this book? Did you follow the proposal and futz along the way, getting paragraphs, getting lines right before you moved on? Or how do you write?
Yeah. Oh, I wish I was the kind of writer who barreled through a first draft. One of my very early teachers 25 years ago or so was Terry McMillan, writer Terry McMillan, and that's the way she writes. And she will write. She said, you have to get out the first draft in no time, in a month or whatever. I don't remember how long it was. And then you can go back a zillion times and make it better. But at least you get the story down and you get the book down. And I've always envied that way of writing. I have a very methodical way of writing where I feel like I need to perfect what I write before moving on. And that's the way I wrote my novel, and that's the way I wrote this book. But unfortunately, it means that your early writing, for me anyway, is too cramped. And then you have to go back. Once the book starts working and starts flowing, maybe a third of the way into it, which is what's happened in my novel and with this book, then it starts, it's more like you push the boulder up the hill and it starts rolling down, and it starts coming more easily. But it does mean that you have to go back, as I did in my novel and in this book, to the earlier chapters and bring that looser, fresher style to the early chapters that didn't really exist there in your first draft because you're trying to figure out what you were going to write. Mm-hmm. You're really writing the bad material that needs to be reshaped into better, fresher material.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting that you also write fiction. I mean, I know a lot of journalists and narrative nonfiction writers that do write fiction, but I'm curious with you if you're still writing fiction, and then also kind of what goes where? You know, like if you're writing nonfiction or you're working on a story or a novel, how do you know when an idea has traction? How did you know with your novel that you had an idea there that you wanted to stay with for the duration?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had no expectation that I would ever be a nonfiction writer or that I would ever work for a newspaper or that I would ever be an editor. My young dreams were all about writing short stories and novels, and that's really all I did, mostly short stories for the late 80s and all of the 90s. And I came to nonfiction by sort of backing into it because my wife had done this book and then I needed to have a male response and that led to the job. And I've backed into all these jobs. Now I really prefer nonfiction and Maybe I have another novel in myself at some point, but that's not what I think about. And when I have a full-time job, I can't justify the time to write a book. It was hard enough shoehorning, you know, the time in to write this book when the book was completely associated with the work that I was already doing. But it's so hard to write a novel in the early stages, or at least it is for me, and to spend all that time writing badly for a book that isn't sold, you know, or that doesn't, that you don't know if it's going to sell, and meanwhile you're falling behind on your day job because you're spending time doing it. Just those practical concerns, sad as it is to say, make it very hard for me to turn my attention to fiction.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I am with Daniel Jones. His book is Love Illuminated, published by William Morrow. Will you talk a little bit about anything, any trends, or what you found with essays coming in regarding internet dating?
Yeah, and I get so much about internet dating. It has really sort of penetrated the psyche to the point where it used to be this embarrassing sideline and last resort that people would turn to, and now it's just automatic for so many people, and so tempting, because unlike going out and trying to meet people in person, you don't know what their situation is, and you don't know who's available and all of that. And you know, here we just have vast catalogs of available people at our disposal, and what I've noticed more than anything is how it sort of upended our approach to our approach to love and what sort of person is best for us. Because there's, you can't date 100,000 people, and so we have to narrow it down, and we narrow it down to people we think, or that an algorithm thinks, will be most compatible with us. But in almost every case, those measures of compatibility turn out to be things that we think are like us, because all these people are strangers, and it's sort of scary to think about dating all these strangers. So we start to get cautious, and we think, well, I don't want to date someone who's, you know, we think in these categories of height and of income and of weight and of smoking or non-smoking and religion. And in almost every case, we're tempted to retreat back into our own tribe and say, well, I wouldn't want to date someone who's, you know, 5'1", and I wouldn't want to date someone who is too far out of my age range and all of these things. And we end up dating people who we think we'd be compatible with, and it's just not so in the real world, where you run into people and you see if there's some sort of connection. It's just, and I'm not even sure we've grappled yet with how it's changing our expectations about love and what we seek out.
I think you said, maybe it was in the Q&A that we did for the ASJ Monthly, that's going to be in April, so all of you out there, if you want to hear more from Daniel, in April in the ASJ Monthly, you can read a Q&A that we have done that will be in. But I think you talked about you and Kathy signing up. And
yes.
Yeah, will you talk about that?
Yeah, this was an experiment that we conducted for the book. And we signed up for two online dating sites. My wife Kathy said that she was widowed, and I said that I was divorced. But otherwise, we answered all the questions honestly, and we waited for our matches to come in. The point in doing it was to find out what the experience was like. But the surprising outcome was that the two of us, and we couldn't be more compatible, if you look at our interests and our tastes and our ages and our hobbies and all across the board, you would think we were very compatible, but we weren't matched up ever on either service, and we were on for a while. And we, even though I do my work in New York, I live in a relatively small town, so we're not talking about huge numbers of people to choose from in that in our demographic, and yet we not only weren't matched up, we were sort of kept apart from each other, it seemed like. And I thought, you know, that's a surprising lesson. Mm. What if we were in midlife and we were in those situations and we might make a very good couple, and yet if we were relying on these two services, we would have been kept from each other.
Yeah, that's interesting. Hey, back to the column. How many essays come in every month?
They're about 400, 500 a month. The odds of getting published have been roughly 1 in 100 for about the past 5 or 6 years, I'd say.
And you're the only reader.
I am the only reader.
So how far will you read? I mean, you know, with books, we hear about agents who will, you know, maybe say yes to a query letter, and then a writer sends the first 50 pages, and they read the first paragraph and say no. Mm-hmm. And other agents will read the first page, and others will read the first first chapter. What about you? I mean, how far do you have to read to know whether it's a possibility?
Well, these submissions are all about six double-spaced pages mm-hmm. long, if they come in at the right length, which most of them do. And I read until I can make a decision. And usually I stop reading because the topic is too familiar or the writer doesn't seem to be familiar with the New York Times or the column because they'll include an explicit sex scene at the beginning, and we don't have explicit sex scenes in the New York Times, so they'll have all kinds of profanity. There is a minority of them, you know, a very small minority, seem like they aren't right, they aren't written in the right way for the standards of the newspaper. But the vast majority of them are written specifically for the column. And then I just have to determine what is fresh about this story. Has the writer learned something? Is the writer just relying on summary too much, and is it dull for that reason? There are all kinds of elements enter into the equation. But I will read as long as I'm interested, and I've come to have a test that I call the iPhone test, which several people have passed when I have been traveling and a submission came in on my iPhone and I just intended to look at it to see what it was and to log it in and couldn't stop reading it mm-hmm. all the way through on my iPhone. And I feel like if you can make me do that, then you're going to make a lot of readers want to read the whole thing too. But these are tough essays to write, and I think it's very deceptive to a lot of readers who think, well, I want to tell my story. It reads so simply. Often mm-hmm. they read so simply, but they're so hard.
Do they go through a lot of editing? Do you go back and forth a lot editing them to get the voice there? Or?
It totally depends on the mm-hmm. on the piece and what the needs are. Sometimes I'll see a full story, but there are obvious things that the writer hasn't addressed, and we'll have a long conversation about it, and often in those situations that conversation will lead to a real revelation about what story could include, and the person will have a better understanding of their own story based on that conversation, almost as if it's a conversation in therapy or something. Mm-hmm. I'm not a therapist, but I think they're similar kinds of questions that I would ask based on what I've read. But yeah, some essays, maybe half of it will be rewritten in various ways, or I'll have the writer revise certain stretches or bring more to it. And some essays go through not as is, but probably 90% of the way there.
Yeah, and I just wanted to comment on something you you talked about a minute ago, which was, getting essays with profanity or you know, explicit sex scenes in the beginning. And
right.
and I just wanted to say that, as with any publication you're interested in submitting to, get familiar with the column.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's so easy to just anymore with, I think, with online submissions to just, you know, shoot something out there and not really know where you're sending to. And
right.
And then you get rejected, and you wonder why.
And I have a very good memory of the column. And often, someone will write and say, "I've been reading the column since the beginning, and you've never done anything about this topic." And then they'll try to sell their topic based on that pitch. But I'll remember that we've done 12 essays on that topic.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it helps just to be more humble and say, "Here's my piece. I hope you enjoy it." You
yeah.
know, rather than trying to pitch it heavily in your cover letter.
Yeah, and it's also a column that published as well as unpublished writers find a home for their essays in. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm totally open to that, and I don't give preference to one over the other. And to tell you the truth, when I read, with the volume that I have to read and the speed that I have to do it, a long cover letter just makes my eyes glaze over.
Mm-hmm.
And publishing credits and book credits, I just don't have time to even pay attention to that. I want to know if the essays are short, you know? So I just turn straight to the essay, and I want to see if that will suit our needs. And I publish so many people for the first time. Sometimes they're aspiring writers. That I'm publishing for where it's really their first, if not their first publication, their first national publication. And in many cases, I publish people who would not describe themselves as writers, and they just had a story to tell, and they're readers of the column, and I could help them tell it. Or maybe if it's a good enough story, it can just be told so simply that language almost doesn't matter. What's interesting to me, though, is that that's the kind of story that the readers appreciate. Readers, we get complaints from readers that, every byline says the person has a book out or whatever, and they see the column as being voices from out there in America, and they don't want these people to be known writers.
Hmm.
They don't care so much if they are, but they don't. They. What's interesting to them is a surprising new voice every week.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, what gives the column its freshness.
Yeah, yeah, and I like that the columns have also sprouted a few books. I remember reading one about one by Alice Fearing some years back about a plumber, her and a plumber,
mm-hmm.
that ended up being her book about wine, or ended up sort of being a skeleton for the book about wine. I found that really interesting how then I, you know, read the book and looked for the column in it, you know, and it was kind of spread out from beginning to end, you know. That's interesting.
And I didn't even know about that one. There have been, I think, at least 38 book deals that have resulted from columns being published that were usually the column having a far richer story
mm-hmm.
buried in it, something that really could be mined for a longer memoir or some sort of theme book about dating or something like that someone has found in it. And I was startled. I'm not much that much of a head for math, but I plugged the numbers in, and it turned out that was like 1 in 12 or 1 in 13 essays published resulted in a book deal, which was stunning to me.
Yeah, I remember Waldman. Waldman. And
yep.
her book about her and Michael Chabon. And,
uh-huh.
You know, that was such a controversial piece. It's interesting when, you know, a controversy arises out of one of the essays.
Yes, and that happens. I mean, people get very stirred up when you make claims about marriage and motherhood. And Ayelet really stirred that pot with her essay, which was talking about the different kind of love you feel for your spouse compared to for your children, and that the romantic, she considered the romantic love she felt for her husband to be a priority of love over her children. And that, in this age of helicopter parenting and where people's children are at the center of their family lives, that was a threatening message to a lot of people. But it was also embraced as a message by so many people who felt like they'd let their marriages languish because they'd completely turned their spotlight onto their children and away from their spouse. So a lot of people, we heard from a lot of people who said, wrote in and said, oh, thank you for this reminder, essentially, that you're shortchanging your kids if you don't have a strong marriage and mm-hmm. you aren't in love with your spouse more than you are shortchanging them if you, you know, if you devote all your attention to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have this book, you have Love Illuminated, you have a few other books, you have freelance work you've done, you have this job, you have kids, you have a wife. So talk about the discipline you have to pull all of this off. I mean, how do you manage?
I was managing pretty well until this book came out and I started traveling for it. And doing media appearances for it, which has lasted for much of February, and now I'll pick up again for the last couple of weeks of March and into April. And now I've truly fallen behind in my life where I can't do my taxes. I can't manage the day-to-day. But it's a manageable life. What is difficult, and this is interesting to talk about for a show about writing, in doing this book, I don't get any break from my job. It's 52 weeks a year. I need to have a column appear, and the submissions don't stop coming in on vacations or anything like that either. So, in order to write this book while having this job, I would need to get ahead and then take a bunch of days off because it wouldn't work for me to write it in little 2-hour stretches late at night or something like that. I really needed to sit down and dig in and do it. But it's funny because I know that you have to write badly before you can write well, and that creating that mess is part of the writing process. But I didn't have the patience to do that with this book, and I thought, if I'm going to take off work to write this book, I can only write well. I don't have time, essentially, to mess around. And that really hurt me in the early stages of trying to write this book. I would get If I spent a day just spinning my wheels, or 2 days spinning my wheels, which again is what you have to do as a writer, I would think, well, I can't do this. You know, this isn't going to work. If I can't just write this well straight out of the gate, then this can't work.
Yeah, that's really.
But it took a while to get over that and just, you know, spend my days spinning my wheels and falling behind at work and dealing with it.
Yeah. Well, we are winding down, and I have a couple more questions, and one is, in writing the book, were there any surprises along the way, or did anything jump out at you that you really didn't expect as you were?
Surprises along the way?
Yeah, in writing the book.
Hello?
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 Are we losing him? I think he...
Can
you hear me?
I heard, yeah, I can.
Yeah, surprises along the way in writing the book.
Most of the trends that I discovered were surprises. They had to do with, you know, in one chapter, I write about infidelity, and I thought, there's nothing that we rationalize as much as infidelity, even though it's supposedly a crime of passion, but we turn to our heads to feel okay about it. And I thought, well, how do we rationalize it? And I'm sitting in this sea of stories, and many of which are about infidelity and people struggling with that and trying to come to terms with it. And it was remarkable how they fell into different sets of arguments so routinely and that people would either say, well, human beings aren't monogamous anyway, and they would have this whole scientific argument for it. Or they'd say, well, you know, what's the point in being bored for your whole life? You know, you need to feel passion, and they'd defend it in that way. And those sorts of trends and common threads in people's thinking when I'd noticed them going across essay after essay, that was always surprising. And that happened in chapter after chapter, where I'd think back over stories and think, oh, well, that's how people behave in those ways. And even though I'd feel averse to categorizing people in simple ways, it was unavoidable. It's just how people broke down.
Interesting. We are at the end of our time. Any advice you've received along the way that stuck with you and that it's been helpful in particular with your writing?
With my writing?
Yeah.
You know, I always remember the line, and I can't remember which famous writer from 100 or 200 years ago said it, but it was the line of how writing, I guess he was talking about a novel, but it might as well be a book of nonfiction like mine, the way I write, which is, writing is like driving across the country at night, and you can only see as far as your headlights show, you know, as far as your headlights illuminate, but you can make the whole trip that way. And I feel like that is advice that has helped me through both of my books. You don't have to see the whole book. You don't even have to see the next chapter. You just have to see what's in front of you and trust that as you move forward, the headlights are going to keep moving forward, and you'll be able to see the next sentence and the next sentence and the next sentence and make the whole journey that way. That's an incredibly reassuring quote for me, and I think about it all the time.
Yeah, it sure is. Daniel, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Barbara. I really enjoyed it.
You're welcome. That was Daniel Jones. His book is Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers, published by William Morrow. And as I said somewhere in there, he will be the keynote at the nonprofit ASJA Annual Writers Conference in April. And you can find out more about the conference at asja.org. Also, I mentioned the Q&A. That I did with him. It'll be in the April issue of the ASJA Monthly, which is online. You can Google it and find it, and lots of other articles, mostly for nonfiction writers, but we throw in pieces about agents and fiction and all kinds of stuff, and the business of writing, which no matter what you're working on, you need to know. What else is going on? Another event coming up is put on by the nonprofit group Sisters in Crime, which I just joined. There's monthly meetings here in Orange County for writers of anything, and they're free events. I went to one with a handwriting analyst that's going to come on the show in April, I think. And our wonderful Dennis Palumbo was there as well. But the event I'm talking about is a day-long writers' conference called Ladies of Intrigue, which will be on March 29th in Huntington Beach. And there will be around 14 LA and Orange County writers, panelists, and moderators with panel topics, including Tough Cookies, Strong Female Protagonists, Down a Dark Alley, How Setting Shapes Story, and you know what? This sentence isn't punctuated that was sent to me. How Setting Shapes Story. There it is. How Setting Shapes Story. And Passport Required, Mystery Goes International. It'll take place on March 29th in Huntington Beach. You can find out more by visiting the Sisters in Crime website at ocsistersincrime.org. And anything else, other literary events in the area, you can visit my website at penonfire.com. And that is all we have time for today. Thank you for listening. This show, along with many others, should be podcast fairly soon, whatever that means, within the next month at penonfire.com. The archive is at writersonwriting.blogspot. And that's it. You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. Thank you so much for listening.